everybody. This is Sean T. Collins. I write the Song of Ice and Fire blog, All Leather Must Be Boiled, at boiledleather.com, and I participated in the annotated Game of Thrones for subtext.com for the iPad with Elio Garcia from Westeros and Anne Grohl, the editor of A Song of Ice and Fire. And joining me today
is Stefan Sasse. I am the contributor of Tower of the Hand, who brought you the extensive essay series of The War of the Five Kings, the follow-up essays regarding A Dance with Dragons, the Dance with Dragons reread project, and of late a very infamous article about badasses and how they are perceived as honorable while they are not in reality. And that's the stuff we are talking about today. And The next topic in this second part of our podcast will be two questions at once. The first of it will be, what constitutes a good ruler in Westeros? And the second, to what point can and will there be political reform in Westeros? So, we were talking about Jon and Dany before we broke up for the first part. And the both of them are, I think, prime examples for the question, because they so clearly stand for two extremes. Jon trying to integrate the wildlings into the realm and doing this with a very autocratic kind of leadership, while Dany tries to rule by compromises on her very own beliefs, and both of them fail to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So I think the question, what is a good ruler in the context of Westeros? Because so many people think Tywin Lannister is the prime example for a good ruler. So I suggest let's first try to explore what makes Tywin Lannister perhaps a good ruler in Westeros context.
Well, I guess that would, I mean, it's quite simply that, you know, he won. And sort of, you know, the ends justify the means. Now, again, I think I said this in our last segment, that we can debate whether he really won, because he's sort of going to be presiding. Well, first of all, he's not presiding over much of anything anymore. Second of all, he's presiding over sort of a ruined kingdom. But yeah, you know, I think when people say that Tywin is a good ruler, what they mean is that he'll do what it takes to get the job done. You know, and perhaps they even buy his argument about the Red Wedding, that, you know, isn't it better to kill a few dozen people around a dinner table than tens of thousands of people on a battlefield? You know, but there, I think right there in that particular example, you can see the problem, because it's not like Tywin only killed a few dozen people around a dinner table. He also killed tens of thousands of people, not just on battlefields, but in their homes, in their fields. You know, he really loosed the dregs of his army upon innocent people. So I think you really have to swallow a lot of very, very bad conduct, not just in moral terms, might I add, but in practical terms, because as we've discussed, you know, he put the torch to crops that people are going to need to survive, including his own people, if he has any plans on ruling over the Riverlands and drawing any kind of benefit from that, yes, rather than simply stretching his army thin to guard over, you know, a wasteland. You know, he needed that food as badly as anybody else did.
I think we have to differentiate between two kinds of good rulers in Westerosi terms, because on the one hand, there are the good rulers watched from the point of view from other nobles. And on the second hand, there are good rulers watched with the eyes of the small folk. And these two can really, really differentiate very much. Because for the small folk, obviously, a good ruler is one that they don't notice. Basically, because there is no such thing as welfare state or bureaucracy or whatever. So
right,
in most cases, when you come into contact with your lord, it's bound to be something bad. Either he wants his taxes, you've done anything and are now sent to the wall or what have you. It's always bad. So I think
A
good ruler for the small folk is one who leaves them in peace. And most rulers, quite interestingly, qualify for this for this thing most of the time. Even the Boltons, we get this quiet rule, quiet land thing that Roose Bolton tries to teach to his bastard son Ramsay in Dance with Dragons, when he mentions that the people will accept the rule when the outrages are kept hidden and when you don't bother them too much. And I think most lords will abide to that principle. It is a wholly different thing, though, when you regard the nobles, because for them, a good ruler seems to keep his own country out of the war, bring the war to other countries to conquer. Every lord who conquered something is automatically a good ruler, at least to some degree. And if they let grow the honor of the house, the respect that others get for the house. We have this with Tywin Lannister, because his father, he really lost all respect of his vassals and of other houses for House Lannister, and he was the one who restored the honor of House Lannister. This point is stressed several times in the books. And I think for the nobles, that these are important things when you value an effective ruler.
Yeah. You know, and there is something, too. You do, as a ruler, need to command some respect. That is true. You know, I think it was probably bad for the people of Casterly Rock and bad for their subjects that Tywin's father was a laughingstock, because let's say he wanted to do something that would be to their benefit. You know, he has that much less leverage to get people to go along with it. You know, we needn't suppose that everything a lord wants to do is a shitty thing. You know, so there is something to needing, you know, needing to command some respect. But at the same time, well, let me put it this way. You brought up Roose Bolton and his notion of sort of, you know, keeping things nice and calm, regardless of what else you do. And I've seen people say, you know, I'd rather live under Roose Bolton than under, you know, some other more well-intentioned lord where things went badly. And, you know, Roose's viewpoint works fine unless you're the woman he's raping, because he was riding by and saw you and found you attractive.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I think, you know, we may touch on this sort of thing more later on, but when you look at the Arab Spring going on right now in the real world, what you have for the most part were a variety of autocracies and dictatorships that, because they didn't sort of flaunt it in the face of the West in whatever way, were allowed to sort of be the Roose Boltons of the world, you know. You know, they sort of kept things quiet. What they did to their people, they did sort of away from Western eyes, you know, and so could sort of get away with it. And eventually those chickens appear to have come home to roost, you know, and unfortunately a very violent way in many places. But, you know, it's just because, you know, things aren't sort of in your face doesn't mean that I'd want to live under someone like Roose Bolton, who is a dictator and who does really view the people that he governs as his property.
Yeah, this is an interesting comparison because from what we hear in Dance with Dragons, these conditions with Roose really behaving in a way that by no means can be justified. He does this for quite a long time, as it seems, and I haven't heard one word from Eddard Stark about, oh my god, this Roose Bolton, he's such an asshole, and if he continues with that, I have to root him out, or something like that. Either Eddard didn't see it, or he didn't want to see it. Knowing Eddard, I think he really didn't see it, but since the Boltons seem quite a brutal and cruel people in general, other lords will surely have noticed and decided not to interfere, because while they have the moral obligation to do so, even by Westerosi standards, because of the whole concept of honor we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
The pragmatic thing is that you don't go to war with one of your vessels and risk an uprising with other vessels just because this lord raped some women and fed them to the dogs. And that is the very harsh reality in the whole of Westeros, that when you are not a noble, your life doesn't really count something at all.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and to bring it back to Dany and Jon, in terms of evaluating whether they are good rulers and you know, however we want to define good, it occurs to me that, like you said, it does seem likely that this, you know, beyond rumors, the truth about the Boltons' depravity never reached Ned. Because once it came out that Ramsay was, in fact, a serial killer, a serial rapist and killer, you know, he was sentenced to death and escaped only by, you know, pretending to be somebody else, and then escaped because of the change in fortunes between the Starks and the Boltons. So it seems safe to assume that Eddard hadn't really heard the extent of it. The difference, then, between society in the North under the Starks and society at the Wall under Jon, or society in Essos under Dany, is that Dany and Jon provide ample opportunities, much more so than just having your stable master eat with you every, you know, once every week or whatever, for the small folk and for people outside their inner circle to interact with them directly. And this creates like a whole new set of obligations for them as rulers. You know, once Dany hears directly from a shepherd that one of her dragons killed and ate his child, if she had not had that sort of counsel where anyone in her whole domain could come and present themselves to her and give these grievances to her, you know, basically the events of A Dance with Dragons wouldn't have taken place. The dragons wouldn't have been chained up, and, you know, surely the armies wouldn't dare attack her. Things would have gone different with Quentin Martell. So much would have changed. You know, and obviously there's an ability, I think, from what we've seen in Westeros, to petition for the redress of grievances, to use the phrase from the United States Constitution. But it seems like Dany and Jon place much more of an emphasis on talking directly to the sort of people who have been ruled out of society elsewhere. And as rulers, that then forces them to evaluate a whole new set of circumstances and make a whole new set of decisions. And as you said, they do it in very different ways.
Yeah, especially regarding Jon and Dany. I mean, I wrote these four follow-up essays regarding Dance with Dragons, and I call them War in the East, Peace in the East, War in the North, Peace in the North. And I try to find out how these two rulers tried to construct a lasting peace, mm-hmm. and what obstacles they encountered, and why they ultimately failed. And it is interesting to see that both of them tried to enact major reforms, and that both of them met with the mindsets of people with conservatism and obligations and privileges that they would shake, and convictions that were suddenly called to question. Slavery on the one hand, and the wildlings as the one enemy you have on the other hand. And it is interesting how they do it, because they both choose approaches that are entirely different from each other. Jon has this very clear-cut vision. I did in my essay a several-point list, which he more or less mechanically works down point by point, and which really makes an awful lot of sense. It is pure reasoning behind what Jon does. It is the logical course. But what he totally rules out of his own equation is that other people might not be able to make the same reasoning that he does, mm-hmm. and that his reasoning is based on several events in his own past that others might not have. He really is ruling out the human factor totally. Yeah. And he does not compromise. He knows he is right, and so he orders other people to do it. And ultimately, that is where he fails. While Danny, on the other hand, is very much aware of such things. She keeps discord. She puts on her floppy ears, as she puts it, tries to honor the traditions of the Myrinese. She tries to broker with the several power factions to integrate her own power base with the freedmen, with the Unsullied, and stuff into this new political system. And ultimately, she also fails. And the question is, and I have no conclusion for it, no final solution, which of the two approaches is the better one, and why do they really fail ultimately? Which of them should be taken as a lesson, and what of this should be taken as a lesson by rulers in Westeros and Essos?
Yeah, you know, it's a very difficult question because, you know, I think we agree that they both were trying, what they wanted to do was right. I mean, you said it, I think, dead on with John. Like, he's right. What he was trying to do, it was the logical, smart thing to do. He was just a terrible, terrible salesman for it. He almost disregarded the need to sell it to anyone. You know, and I think, again, you cited in our previous segment, Jaime's youth influencing how he handled his situation with King Aerys and killing King Aerys. I think, again, with Jon, his youth probably impacted how he went about selling these changes or not selling these changes and how things were going to be to his fellow men of the Night's Watch. You know, I think it was probably a similar situation with Dany, too, who's younger even than Jaime was. You know, as queen with this conquering army and these three, you know, living, breathing nuclear weapons that she has, you know, there's a degree to which they simply can't see beyond, you know, sort of what their years and their experience enable them to see. And like you said, you know, how they deal with that is very different. John just plows ahead. Danny, almost to a fault, involves the feelings and desires of everyone surrounding her. But, you know, here I think is really where the meat of the issues that we're talking about today exists, in that because John and Danny failed as a practical matter, a lot of readers reject what they were trying to do as a philosophical matter, or as an ethical matter. The idea that John really shouldn't care about who survives north of the wall, in terms of the wildlings who are left behind after the battle, or the idea that Danny, you know, either should never have tried to free the slaves, or that now that she's done what she's done, you know, she needs to just sort of wash her hands of it, leave them to their own devices, and then take the dragons and just plow a path of destruction all the way to the Iron Throne. I think that's, you know, we obviously have to look at how noble intentions actually play out practically. That's important. But, you know, the idea that Dany failed because she's insufficiently brutal, because she's insufficiently warlike, because she's insufficiently focused simply on taking back the crown that is rightfully hers, you know, that her ancestors stole from a bunch of other people, but that now is, I guess, rightfully hers. You know, I don't see that as the lesson that we are to draw from her situation in Meereen. I don't see that the lesson we're supposed to draw from John getting stabbed by his men is that he should have just said, well, to hell with the wildlings. You know, that's, to me, that's the wrong interpretation. And definitely, it's important. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this is, what lessons will the two of them draw from this, provided that John will survive? Because the last Danny chapter of The Dance with Dragons gave me the impression that she draws exactly the conclusions that you just mentioned, that she needs to be this warrior queen, this brutal conqueror, and put aside all the will to compromise, all the regard for existing traditions, for stuff that she cared about before, and that she just has to take her dragons and burn everything in her path. And that seems like a very dangerous road that she is heading currently. And
yeah.
John, he could, if he is revived in some kind of form, draw the exact same conclusions about doing it in a more brutal way. But I guess that this is not what they should draw as conclusions from this.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say, by the way, you know, this is important, that if, you know, that I want George R. R. Martin to turn these people into Martin Luther King, you know, or Gandhi, and that I'll be unhappy if they don't behave, even if the good guys, quote-unquote, don't behave in a way that's sort of commensurate with, you know, contemporary ideals about how political leaders should behave. If he ends up writing Dany as sort of this born-again ass-kicker who takes her dragons and just has a scorched earth policy, you know, that's fine if it's well done. You know, all I'm saying is that, you know, based on his writing so far, I would imagine that he wouldn't then be like, yay, isn't this great that she's doing that? And sort of expect us to have that reaction any more than we're supposed to think it's wonderful that the reborn Catelyn Stark, you know, is now this merciless monster who is hanging people left and right and abandoning, you know, all the warmth that characterized her as a person. Like, are we happy that maybe there are fewer Freys and Lannisters around, you know, from the perspective of someone who's taking sides in these books as fiction? Yeah, you know, I'm not going to weep for these people. But it's a sad thing, and it's a bad thing that this is what Catelyn, or Caitlin, depending on how you want to pronounce it, has become. And I think that's the same is true, you know, if that's the direction Dany and John go in, even if they end up winning that way, you know, I think we're meant to examine the cost of living that way. You know, the same thing is true of Arya. Okay. You know, she's a little child who's now becomes this sort of, you know, vengeful creature, and she has every right to be angry and every right to want revenge. And if she were to kill any of the people on her list, I really wouldn't weep for any of them. But it would be a sad thing for Arya as a person, I think, to be reduced to this sort of being of violent retribution. And, you know, that's important to consider, I think, with both Dany and Jon, if and when their stories continue from where we've seen them leave off at the end of A Dance with Dragons.
Yeah.
That's, you know, these things have costs to them as people that we're meant to consider. Beyond simply the question of like, oh, they got what they wanted. You know, they achieved their objectives. It goes a lot deeper than that. If it didn't, I don't think we'd be reading these books, frankly.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
I also want to emphasize, and I try to do this in the comment section at the Tower of the Hand regarding the strong reactions that there were towards my essay about Blackfish being a giant asshole and Tywin Lannister too,
mm-hmm.
because I very well appreciate the characters as characters in A Song of Ice and Fire. I know they are well written. I know that they fit into this world perfectly.
I
don't denounce them as characters as they are written. The point that I am trying to emphasize is that we shouldn't regard them as paragons for our own lives in the 21st century. And I think that some people, to a certain extent, blur this up a bit. And they have always done that, even before Song of Ice and Fire came out. They just used other books and stories before that. But it is a dangerous mindset that can lead to much suffering. In reality, when you are not aware of what the cost of, and here I'm quoting, ruling efficiently is, because
mm-hmm.
It comes at a terrible price, and many people don't really have that on their radar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this is an issue, now that I think about it, that I've thought about and written about in a lot of different contexts recently in terms of fiction. The television show Mad Men, superhero comics, and it's something I call the competence fantasy, the way that readers or viewers identify with characters based on how awesome they are. Like you said, the sort of badass vibe that they give off. Like, are they really kick-ass, awesome, like, tough to top, tough to beat, and that's sort of privileged over almost anything else that goes into a character. So you get these people who watch Mad Men and sort of cheer for the character of Don Draper, who is, you know, the main character, this advertising executive.
Yeah, I have seen it.
Yeah, you know, and whose personal behavior is fairly abominable, but because he's stylish and handsome and talented, that you know, I don't mean to dismiss that, you know, people sort of root for him and identify with him. And so when he makes bad decisions, they identify with him less, because that's what they were interested in. They were interested in this alpha male, and that happens in superhero comics all the time. And it happens here. You know, I've seen people say that their problem with the Dance with Dragons is that Daenerys had been so competent and so precocious as this sort of child ruler, that to see her get bogged down in this mess, this sort of, with this counterinsurgency and these warring factions and being besieged and spending all this time having sex with this dude that they don't like. They don't like her as a character anymore, because she's made bad decisions. And it, you know, but that's, as you say, is very, very strange. And you know, to believe that you can only like this character insofar as this character is doing everything right. And when they start doing something wrong, they're no longer a well-written character. I mean, it's as you say, like Tywin and the Blackfish.
Yeah.
You know, you disagree with what they did. You know, from a moral perspective, you find them fairly abominable people. But that's not to say that Martin did something wrong by writing them that way.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and to me, that's true of Danny and John. You know, they made a lot of mistakes in this book. But, you know, as you say, like, it cuts both ways. You don't want to identify with people solely because they're badass, and you don't want to stop identifying with people because they're no longer badass. Because in everyday life, which is ultimately what fiction is about in some way, you know, people contain these contradictions. And the idea that we should privilege success, you know, which in A Song of Ice and Fire is usually won at the end of a sword, the idea that is the ultimate thing that we need to focus on, you're right, I think it leads to a lot of heartache.
Yeah, absolutely. When you mention superhero comics, I think another great example is Watchmen, because so many people in this story root for Rorschach, which is something else I can't get my mind about, because this guy is a badass, yes, and he has several very cool lines, but you can't really root for someone like that, because he is so immoral, so cruel, such an asshole, really, and someone you don't want to meet ever. And it is the same thing in A Song of Ice and Fire, too. And regarding Dany, when she seemed so competent, she was always in a destructive way. When she went to Carth, she conquered more or less the House of the Undying. She managed to escape them and to burn down their foul temple or whatever it is. I'm really looking forward to it in the second season for Game of Thrones, how they will depict it.
Absolutely.
But when she does that, she destroys something, and it is not really her that is so much competent, but the dragons. Then she is in Astapor, where she is decisive, to say the least, when she really goes all in on this stuff with the Unsullied, because she can really know how it will play out and if it will work at all. And she just does it, and she has success, yes. But there is no guarantee for it. And the same thing is true when she seduces the mercenary leaders. There is no guarantee that this works. They could have stayed loyal to Yunkai, and then crushed her whole host. She just had this streak of luck, so to speak, and the same thing in Marine. She got these people who told her about the sewers, and that's why she had success. And then her luck runs out, and she has to prove herself on her own merits in Marine. And I think she does a pretty good job, actually, especially regarding how young she is, how inexperienced she is. She has a very firm imagination, like John does, for the future of the constituency she now has accepted. John with the Night's Watch and the Wildlings, Danny has Marine. They both have strong ideas, as well in where to go as in how to go there, and they try to do it. Mm-hmm. And they both meet obstacles they didn't have predicted, and they overcome some of them, but not all.
Right.
And the way in which they ultimately fail is according to the epic proportions of the whole enterprise that they were going to go, because they not only try to rule like Tywin Lannister did, or Edmure Tully, or Doran Martell, or all these other guys, but they mm-hmm. also, additionally to being young, having a potentially hostile environment to rule, and being inexperienced, they also have a very ambitious reform agenda. And it is amazing how far they get before they fall, and not that they fall at all.
That's a really excellent point, that they had, even the success that they did achieve, is really remarkable. And, you know, to get to our point that we wanted to talk about how or whether political reform could be achieved in Westeros, I think you have to say based on or in Essos, I think you have to say based on the case of both Danny and John, that it is possible. You know, they got very far, as you point out, and had they made certain decisions differently, had John been a little more conciliatory towards Bowen Marsh, had he made a few more concessions in terms of the perhaps the pace at which he was doing things, or had Danny had things gone differently with Danny's dragons, had a number of circumstances prevailed differently in Meereen, you know, they could have gone even farther, and who's to say that they won't? You know, obviously this series is not over, so I reject the idea that it's impossible, that we shouldn't even be thinking about a more equitable or just society in Westeros or in Essos. Now, how will it happen? I guess I would have to imagine that for something to really happen, you'd need quite a wholesale change in the political fortunes of these areas. You know, and I assume, just from having read a lot of fiction, that that's sort of where things are headed, whether because of the others or because of Dany's invasion. Things will change significantly on the ground in terms of the power relationships. And what you need at the top when the dust settles and the smoke clears and the snows melt is someone like Danny and John willing to do that work. Because I also think that what you're seeing, and this is maybe the most important thing about the books, about the series so far, that what you've seen in the War of the Five Kings is a demonstration that this system doesn't work. That it lends itself to brutality, to a sort of network of allegiances that can keep the peace for a while, but then when things do go bad, it makes things a million times worse. That's always sort of the lesson that we learned, you know, that I learned in history classes in elementary school about World War I, which is that these sort of secret treaties and these alliances that were formed by these countries, you know, rather than working against war, you know, they kind of dragged everyone in. And I think you see this sort of sense that Westeros, you know, with just this one push with, you know, these two families, you know, tossing children out windows and arresting people in inns and breaking each other's legs in alleyways, the whole system collapsed in on that. So I think you need reform. I don't even think, you know, I think that's a question that we have an answer to. Form is required if the society is going to survive, because things are going to go a lot worse for it during the winter and with the coming of the others.
Definitely.
And they would have otherwise. I think that's maybe the most important thing. Even before you get into whatever concerns you and I might have as people of the 21st century about how the small folk are treated, slavery, the role of women in particular.
Yes, we
don't need to address that. It's from a practical perspective, this has been a disaster, this system.
Yes, we will delve into the question of the 21st century people later, but right now when you say that the whole system of Westeros is failing, I think you are right, because quite simply they cannot live up to the expectations they were setting themselves, especially in what we talked in part one of the podcast with the honor system. They simply can't deliver what they promised to do. And they are only still around because there is nothing that can replace them, because of the pragmatic conditions of the world. There is no possibility to communicate. Most people are uneducated, so the system can go on, but it really is broken and rotten to the core. And the people are not, the nobles, not the people in general, the nobles, are not able to reform it from within. So I think we should just have a look now at two rulers who try to reform and how they do it, John and Danny. And what we haven't done in this podcast up until now is to include a third one, because we should remind ourselves that Dance with Dragons and The Feast for Crows are in fact one big book. And we don't only visit Jon and Dany trying to make peace, but we also have Cersei to take in account, because she is the third ruler in this book, and she also tries to organize a peace. And I just take a leap of faith here, and I say she's the one trying to maintain a status quo. She's the one with no reform inspirations at all. All she wants to do is to keep the current system and to get as good as possible a place in it. So what we should do now, I think, is to work through these three different rulers and how they try to reform or not to reform their political agenda. And I would just suggest that we start with John, because he's such a handsome guy, and and look at the reform he tries to initiate into Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just get started on this, because obviously I wrote this large essay about it. So just make a little commercial break. Read my essay. I think we can get a link for it at some place later. So
okay,
let's go back to the topic. John tries to widen the society of Westeros, because up until now the wall has been this barrier between the civilized world and the world that is not so much civilized. One character at one point, I don't remember who or when, just says that being on the one side of the wall or the other is merely a product of chance, and that the people aren't so different, but just born on other sides of this monumental structure. And John is the one trying to bring the wildlings back into human society. He's the first who tries to regard them as human beings, and who has a sense, with the background of the looming threat of the others, that all humans on the whole continent, and in fact in the whole world, are of the same flock, as the lamb people would put it. He has this very unusual few on the world, without abandoning, of course, and being noble and such stuff like that. He's not egalitarian in any case, but he accepts that all humans are belonging together on a certain level, and that they enjoy some common rights on some level. And this is a revolutionary thought, because up until now no one would have drawn a line combining every human being in Westeros with a common trait, being human. That was never never a topic for anyone. There was small folk, there was nobles, and both together could loathe the wildlings on the other side of the wall. And now John crashes down this predicament. He tries to let the people see that they are all humans. And I think that is really the most revolutionary of all agendas. And I'm not quite sure if he truly understands what he is doing, but that is why he needs so much resistance, in my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's I think you're right, you know, because what he's doing first and foremost from a practical perspective. He does believe that these are human beings and entitled to the protection of the Night's Watch, which is, you know, that's a moral point of view. That's a moral argument that he's making. But, the reason he's even making it is because of this external threat of the others and of the whites. And if that didn't exist, he probably wouldn't be saying these things and doing these things. So circumstances have radicalized him in a way.
Yeah.
As often happens in history, certain things are done for expediency's sake, that end up really sort of recalibrating the way people think about themselves and about other people. So once you do let the wildlings through the wall, once you marry them to your lords, and just your small folk, and once you stop treating them as these sort of monstrous, demonic, cannibalistic creatures, basically, and you differentiate them from the actual monstrous, cannibalistic, demonic creatures, and start treating them like people, that's going to have consequences down the road, far beyond just the desire to, you know, spare their lives and also, you know, prevent the others from recruiting them, you know, as zombies. Which, again, is the practical element here. So you're right, you know, it's a very radical realignment of how humanity is looked at by people in Westeros, but it's pushed along by very, very practical, simple concerns about the coming battle with the others.
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing, because Jon is very much a conservative reformer. All the wildlings coming south of the wall, they have to accept the existing system, they have to swear allegiance, all these structures with lords and vassals, they aren't touched at all. He more or less tries to integrate them into it. He is rather delicate with it. He is not forcing too much from the wildlings. It never even occurs to him that in this revolutionary reform he is enacting, he could topple the whole aristocracy of Westeros or something like that. That is nothing that Jon wants. He more or less wants to make the wildlings part of a greater humanity that works on the principles it has always worked, but if possible, better. He is more or less something like an enlightened monarch, so to speak. He has more of a concept of what he is doing. He's more aware of things happening when you rule than most other lords are, who just consider this as their privilege and simply do it because they were born into it. For John, there is a little bit more about it. He accepts the challenges, he accepts the implications of the job he has and of the policies he tries to enact.
Right, right.
I think that is the main point about John.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, it's interesting to compare him to Dany. I think Dany does what she does primarily for emotional reasons, and that's not to dismiss that at all. You know, that's not an insult, because she has clearly a more finely honed moral impulse than a lot of these characters that we meet. And she recoils with the appropriate horror at, sort of the brutality of war that she experiences, whether it's the rape of the Lamb people, literally, by the Dothraki, and then the conditions she encounters when she enters Slaver's Bay and goes to Astapor and sees the conditions the slaves under which the slaves live. You know, so in a way, it's almost it's the opposite of John. Dany could probably get what she wants a lot easier if she simply bought the Unsullied, or you know, sort of gathered a power base from Essos by promising them the riches of Westeros if they help her. You know,
yeah.
But she didn't. You know, and perhaps it's her background coming out. You know, she's lived a life on the run. She's lived a life of abuse at the hands of Viserys. She's, you know, lived a life very, very informed by brutality, by killing. You know, I mean, that's her whole life story begins with the death of her family. And I think that makes her perhaps more finely attuned to the suffering of others, more empathetic. So it's, you know, she's not coming at it from a sort of conservative temperament. You know, she's willing to burn it all down, and try and build a new society in its place that, does require a lot out of everybody.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're making very good points here with this moral compass she has. That's something that hasn't occurred to me before. It is really interesting. You know, I can almost picture Daenerys as a character in a movie like Kingdom of Heaven. She would fit in perfectly there with this, let's build a kingdom of conscience and stuff. I really like that movie, by the way, because of this. And I think Dany is a real interesting case regarding this moral compass and what derives from it, because she clearly sees herself as queen. That is her right. That is her birth, and
yeah.
She wouldn't ever call that into question. Her thrive for a better world, which she obviously pursues, does not include overthrowing monarchy, but I have the strong feeling that she is very much willing to overthrow everything else between the whole establishment, so to speak. I think it would not make a difference for her if in the end she sits the Iron Throne, and below her there are no lords anymore, no ladies, but just people. The main thing is that there is one queen or king remaining, but she is able and willing to go very far in actually opposing and overthrowing the current system as much as it touches her moral compass and is deemed by her to be unfair. We can experience this with the slaves, because I don't think that she really knows or has acknowledged yet what the freeing of the slaves means for the world in which she moves. But it is a revolution, a real revolution. And
yeah.
All the powers
yeah.
around her have taken up arms against her. It's like the French in the French Revolution in 1791, when all of Europe took up arms against this new French Republic to bring them back to quell these ideas that they had developed and are now in danger of spreading. And when Quentin and Tyrion are in Volantis, we can see how far grown this danger already is, because
mm-hmm.
these ideas, you can't get them out of the world anymore. The only hope
right.
of the establishment is to defeat Dany so thoroughly that everyone who harbors these ideas too is discouraged. But she is a revolutionary. Whether she has acknowledged that for herself or not does not really make a difference, because of this emotional and moral compass she has. It
right.
it sets her on the track inevitably.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. And you're right, for the parties aligned against her, it is an existential threat that she presents simply by existing. And they really need to extirpate her entire rule and influence. And they still might not be able to unring the bell. You know, the ideas that are put out there, as you say, have spread to Volantis, you know, around the night fires. That's what the people are talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to imagine that it's what she's done is much bigger than her. And it's interesting, as you point out, that, you know, obviously her ideas about human rights have not spread so far internally to make her question her own divine right to be queen. That hasn't changed. But this may, you know, it. Who knows? I mean, again, she's very young. We have a few books left, and we don't know how she'll feel about things as she grows. You know, she's displaying, even at her weakest, the sort of Targaryen fire, and this belief in her own rightness to rule. You know. But like we've been saying, you know, this idea that she's sort of put out there has a lot more ramifications than she thought through when she first did it. And, you know, it could reverberate within her as well. And we don't really know where her personal and political journey will end.
It could lead up to a new crackpot theory of sorts, because she is perhaps barren and the people are regarding her as the mother, so it is quite possible that she will rule as queen but regard herself as sort of the last queen ever. That could be a legacy that she could embrace. It sounds to me like something that she would love. It would totally fit with her character arc, but that would lead too far devising such theories now.
Yeah.
But something along these lines I could very well imagine with Dany, but never with Jon. The two of them, quite interestingly, they seem like ice and fire, literally.
Yes.
John has to survive, if only so that these two could meet somehow and clash in whatever way they will resolve around it. But they are destined to meet each other. I'm more convinced than ever.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. And, you know, just real quick before we move on to Cersei, and I think Cersei will probably be the last thing I'm able to tackle today. But with John lives in one of the very few truly egalitarian societies in Westeros, the Night's Watch, where lords and bastards and small folk, in theory at least, all have the same rights and obligations and duties and are brothers. They're at least paying lip service to that with the language that they use, although obviously it seems that the highborn have a much better chance of being named Lord Commander. Historically, so it's not perfect, but it'll be interesting to see if that in any way affects his thinking going forward, despite the sort of more conservative temperament that he has.
Okay, I'm with you there, so I suggest we just hop to Cersei before calling it a hold for today and for the second part. So, Cersei, I said before, is more or less the conservative one. She wants to keep the status quo, and she has no ambitions whatsoever to change anything. I have the strong feeling that she even lacks the imagination necessary for it, because she has never known anything else, and there is no reason for her to try and deteriorate from that.
Yeah, you know, I, when you brought Cersei up, I thought back to our conversation earlier about how the War of Five Kings demonstrates the real weaknesses and limitations of the system. And Cersei is almost the embodiment of that. You know, in many ways, Cersei is the ideal user of the system. You know, her primary concern is personal power, personal loyalty, you know, keeping her family in charge. You know, she was really constructed as a person by the system working the way it's supposed to. You know, she married the king, and, you know, now her children are going to be rulers, and, you know, she's the queen regent. But in her, you see all the potential for things going very, very badly. You know, her sort of ability to act completely unchecked, sort of lets loose all sorts of negative forces. You know, she reawakens the militarized faith and sort of this rebirth of violent religious fundamentalism. She lets loose Qyburn, you know, a creature, a person who'd been disgraced and expelled from the Order of the Maesters, now is one of the most influential people in the entire world, really, and is doing God knows what supernaturally. You see in her, I think you see the limitations of Westeros society's view of the role of women. You know, she says many times, you know, she wished she had been born a man. That's really would have been ideal for her. And, you know, and because she wasn't, though, I think she's really poorly equipped to deal with the world around her. She doesn't command the respect a man does, and because of that, she's bitter in a way that a man wouldn't be, a man existing in the system. You know, she's in terms of her sort of Achilles heel or weak point, you know, the faith, once they get the upper hand on her, makes a point of humiliating her sexually and humiliating her as a woman, and using that as sort of her womanness as a weapon against her. So both in what she does and what is done to her, I think you see all the limitations of Westerosi society sort of bearing this horrible fruit of this sort of mad queen.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Yeah.
There is also the matter of the two things that John and Dany respectively have in character traits that she lacks. She has neither the compassion and ability to feel with other people or to bring herself into their position, at least in theory, that Dany has, nor has she any greater idea or awareness of ruling like John has. I mean, Cersei, she wants to rule because she can, because she wants to, but there is no thing behind it, and she's not able at all to feel into other people, which is why she constantly makes these mistakes like arming the faith again, because she can't even imagine what they will do with it. She is refusing the Iron Bank of Braavos without even thinking how these people work. She has no idea at all of the forces, of the political forces, whether they are visible or not, that she is dealing with. And she doesn't care. And she too, as John and Dany, comes very far with that. Surprisingly far. Mm-hmm. Littlefinger kips that he wouldn't never have thought that Cersei ruined the realm so quickly. But looking at her track record, it is surprising that she even managed to hold out that long, because she alienates the people around her at such a speed, and disregards everything that would be pragmatic at such a consequence. Mm-hmm. It is almost admirable. And the interesting thing is, nonetheless, she manages to create a kind of peace within Westeros that at least contains the big conflicts. The conflicts are not evolving anymore when she comes to power. She manages to keep them down on a bearable level. Bearable for her, of course, not for the small folk involved.
Right.
And I don't know exactly why this is.
You know, I think it just could be that, you know, it's as simple as perhaps the Red Wedding really kind of ending the fighting in the Riverlands, and that she could only mess things up so badly after that, you know, because the Lannister victory there was so total, the decapitation strike against the leadership structure of the Starks and the Tullys in the North and the Riverlands, you know, was so complete and demoralizing that there just wasn't time for another force to develop the kind of military power that would be necessary to challenge King's Landing or the Rock or the Reach. Although, as you're seeing, you know, sort of around the edges of Cersei's domain, you have you know, Stannis up north. You know, so it's obviously first the fighting with the wildlings, and then the fighting with the Iron Throne's forces, you know, under the person of Roose Bolton. That's still going on. The Greyjoys are still fighting a little bit in the north, and then, you know, working their way around the coast, you know, to threaten Highgarden. Who knows what the Iron Bank of Braavos will do. You have John Connington coming in out of nowhere. So, you know, I think that her reign is peaceful almost through no fault of her own.
No, definitely not. I think this is more the general neglect that she aims toward everything that does not interest her. She is very, very random in whatever concerns her at the moment. So, she isn't interested in the financial affairs of the realm, but then this Iron Banker, he bugs her, and so she decides some really stupid things, and then continues to doesn't care about it. And the same thing is true about the fighting in the Riverlands. She has Kevin and she has Jaime, and they are taking care, and should something bug her, maybe she will issue a direct order to, I don't know, nuke Riverrun or something like that. It is totally up to her. It's totally random and displays all the negative things about this system, because it is possible to do this within the boundaries of the Westerosi political system and not to be an exception of sorts, but that is totally normal. And that's a bit frightening.
Yeah. It's a very inflexible system. There's really no way to mitigate against Cersei's negative influence without doing something very dramatic, like arresting the queen and forcing her on this walk of shame. You know, there's not a lot of give to the system to sort of push against her. And you know, I've brought this up on my blog, and you know, it doesn't really speak to the meat of what we're talking about today, but I think it's important to remember that Cersei is mentally ill. She's not just a bitch. She's not just mean or evil. I think you can gather enough clues from how Martin writes her, and in my personal case, I can compare it to people that I've known. You know, where with the exception of the people I've known have not been queens, you know, with the power of life or death at their disposal. Everything you see her do, sort of pushing away the people who really have her best interests at heart and embracing people who, to everyone else, it's crystal clear that they don't, that they're bad influences, that they're taking advantage of her, that they're encouraging her worst attributes. You know, I think this is all born out of the trauma of losing her son and her father, you know, in such short order, and her lover and the person of her brother. And I think she's really kind of a broken person. But as you say, you know, there's nothing anyone can do about it, because that's how the system works. You know, she's at the top. She's the mad queen. And unless a queen slayer comes along, there's really not very much that can be done. You know, and that's the system in a nutshell. That if you get lucky and you get a ruler who's kind and consistent and thoughtful and smart and lucky, you can have peace, but it's just as easily lends itself to a lunatic, or someone who's really bloodthirsty or doesn't care. And in that case, you're in trouble.
I think we are concluding as a kind of a circle there, because in a good way, because when we started talking in the first part of our podcast about the concept of honor, we can now see that Cersei is only checked in by totally expelling her from the honor code, from this organization of honor within Westeros. This wall, this walk of shame is only done to completely eradicate her position within this society order, and to put her out of it deliberately. And by doing that, Kevin engineered more or less a guarantee that she can't continue. And this drastic measure was the only thing to be done. And again, it could only be done because, by chance, there was someone in this position of power who could think for himself and had a better idea of what to do with the power. But the system itself lends itself to lunatics and messiahs alike. And that's a big problem, and that's why in our own history we devised separation of powers and checks and balances and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You really see why we need things like that when you look at these characters. And I think that is a fitting conclusion point for this podcast. So if you have anything to add, speak now or be silent forever.
I will be like one of the silent sisters, and I will let this reverberate, and we will contemplate on it and think about it, and it was an excellent conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me too, and I hope that we can continue some time to work on the last points of our list. But for now, I say goodbye to our hopefully many listeners, and until next time.
All right, take care, Stefan. Take care.